Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Five days after the end of the Second World War, Winston Churchill took to the airwaves and made a famous speech to the world. Broadcast over the BBC World Service, he talked about Britain's experience in the war and the difficulties the British people had endured. However, a constant theme in the speech was the policy pursued by the government of Éamon de Valera in the Irish Free State. Back in 1939, they had declared neutrality and outwardly at least had stuck rigidly to this policy, refusing to pick one side or the other. This would even see Éamon de Valera, the Taoiseach of the day, visit the German legation in Dublin to pass on official condolences when it emerged Hitler had committed suicide at the end of the war. Lambasting their position, Churchill proclaimed neutrality had, and I quote, left the de Valera government to frolic with the German representatives to their heart's content. The reality of Irish neutrality in the Second World War was, however, as you might expect, far more complicated. In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Donal O'Driscoll from the History Department of University College Cork. Donal has written extensively on the issue of neutrality, and he reveals why Ireland took a neutral position in the war, and how this was a matter of tactics rather than ideology. He also explains how this led to a somewhat strange situation where the government aided the Allies behind the scenes, but imposed extreme censorship to create the perception that the Free State was neutral. As you're about to hear, there's a lot more to this story than simply declaring neutrality and staying out of the war. Before we dive into this fascinating topic, if this is your first time tuning in, my name is Finn Dwyer and this is the Irish History Podcast. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to the show to get the next episode. Finally, if you're a supporter of the podcast, you now have access to the first episode in my exclusive series on the Irish Civil War that's only available over on Patreon or Acast Plus. If you haven't yet subscribed, for just €5 a month, you can listen to the Civil War series along with the huge back catalogue of exclusive Irish history content available only for supporters. This includes a series on the story of the Black Death in Ireland, bonus shows on the Great Hunger and the War of Independence. And you can support the show and get all this content today at patreon.com/Irish Podcast. Just to say, there won't be an episode next week because of the bank holiday, but I'll be back the week after. Now, let's turn the clock back to 1939. The storm clouds of war are building in Europe, and to begin, I asked Donal where Ireland's position of neutrality originated. Did it have deep roots in our history?
Yeah, I mean, there's various debates amongst historians regarding the neutral tradition, or whether Ireland did have a neutral tradition sort of before the Second World War, if you know what I mean. Now, there's no doubt that it was the Second World War when the policy was originated, when it was first activated. But certain people, you know, Ronan Fanning and Patrick Keating and others who've written on this have kind of argued that there was a kind of a predilection towards neutrality in Irish nationalism pre-independence and in Irish policy post-independence. Others would challenge that, and really the evidence is pretty flimsy, I think. You know, we have James Connolly's Irish Neutrality League, obviously. We have the whole opposition to conscription in 1918. We have the opposition to the Boer War and so on. But, you know, they can just as easily be seen as anti-British, if you like, or directly anti-imperialist sort of factors. So the idea of new Irish neutrality didn't feature in the treaty debates, for example, or in the treaty negotiations. you know, it wasn't asserted as a policy in the 1920s by Cumann na Gael. So even though there's occasional sort of nods towards and that maybe we should take a sort of a neutral position, really it's only with the collapse of collective security, I think, in, you know, with the demise of the League of Nations in 1935-36, that De Valera for the first time declares we want to be neutral. And that really becomes a practical and achievable state policy then in 1938 with the return of the treaty ports under the Anglo-Irish sort of agreement of that year. Because before that, of course, the ports of Lough Swilly and Cove and Bearhaven were under British naval control. So there's absolutely no way that Ireland could have been neutral in any war that broke out if the British still control those ports. So it then became an achievable policy. De Valera sort of stated in 1938 that, you know, in what's considered to be a statement of Irish aspirations towards neutrality, that we want to be neutral, but it was highly qualified. I have the quote here. He says, assuming other things were equal, if there was any chance of our neutrality in general being possible, we would probably say that we want to remain neutral. I do not know that you can follow that up by saying in any war, but in general, our desire would be for neutrality as far as possible. Now, that's hardly a kind of a unequivocal statement of, you know, principled neutrality. And he made it very clear that our neutrality, and as it came to being in 1939, that our neutrality was not theoretical or abstract in any way, that it was a case of we want to stay out of this war.
So as Donal explained, while neutrality might have roots in Irish nationalism, it wasn't ideological in the 1930s. So this leads us to the question, why did Ireland remain neutral then in the Second World War?
When the war breaks out, there's a whole sort of range of factors, I think, influencing the decision to declare our neutrality or non-belligerence. And, you know, they're both practical and symbolic, really. So, I mean, in practical terms, it kind of made sense. Most people don't want to be involved in a war, you know, if you can avoid it. That's the first thing. Ireland didn't have any kind of imperialist or strategic interests that were under attack or threatened by, you know, by the war itself, by German expansionism or otherwise. It was less than 20 years since the end of the Civil War and the War of Independence. So, you know, the divisions within Irish society, this kind of the trust in British intentions, the memories of the Black and Tans and British atrocities, you know, all of these things. And of course, the continuation of partition. All of these things would have influenced the political class and public opinion in the sense of, you know, do we want to join a war on Britain's side? Do we want to fight with the Black and Tans? Essentially, of course not. So that wasn't an option, really, in domestic political terms. It would have created much too much division. There was fear that there would be a civil war, another civil war in Ireland, if Ireland joined the war, you know, on the British side. The IRA still were active. They'd actually declared their support for Germany in some senses. They had declared war on Britain in the summer of 1939 before the actual war broke out and, you know, launched bombing campaigns and so on. And the IRA was still capable of mobilizing emotional sort of responses in Irish political life. So there was a fear that, you know, joining the war on the British side would provoke, you know, possible civil war. Joining the Germans, the Axis was just impractical. And I mean, it simply wouldn't have been possible and wouldn't have had any support outside a tiny group of sort of extreme right-wing nationalists, you know. So for all those practical reasons, it made total sense to declare neutrality. And then symbolically, it was a chance for Ireland to sort of declare its sovereignty, its independence from Britain on the world stage and actually sort of say, look, we can exist as an independent state. We don't have to follow Britain and everything she does. So, you know, for all those practical and symbolic reasons, neutrality was declared at the outbreak of war and maintained right to the bitter end in 1945.
While the government chose to remain neutral, I asked Donal how the wider public reacted to this move. Understanding this is tricky, as Donal explains.
Well, it's very hard to judge in the sense that there was a censorship. We'll talk about censorship in a moment, I'm sure, but that there was a censorship system that was extreme, that was probably the most, outside of in democratic countries, the most extreme censorship system in any democratic country that set out to neutralize, as I call it, Irish public opinion on the war in order to bolster support for neutrality policy. As the war goes on, there's increasing, obviously, propaganda is seeping through, despite the censorship net. News of the, you know, German atrocities and so on later on is beginning to influence people and maybe making them question, to some extent, the policy, but that is totally outweighed, I think, by the, again, by the practical and symbolic advantages that we've already sort of talked about. We didn't have opinion polls, but we had two general elections, for example, during the war, both of which Fianna Fáil won. All of the political parties, without exception, supported neutrality. The press in general, while they resented not being able to express opinions on the war, nevertheless believed that neutrality was the most practical and obvious policy to pursue, even the Irish Times, which would have supported the Allies and Britain in the war, but nevertheless believed that neutrality was a sensible policy. And when we have intelligence reports from the British, from the Germans, from the Americans, as the war goes on, where they are, you know, gauging public opinion, they all overwhelmingly state that neutrality was popularly supported by the vast majority of the people. So it seems that, you know, that any opposition that did exist was quite isolated and wasn't given a chance to develop anyway by the very repressive nature of the state at the time, you know.
Declaring neutrality is one thing, but implementing it was another matter entirely. Donal explains how the Irish government enacted its policy of neutrality.
There's no such thing as perfect neutrality. There's no such thing as pure neutrality. It doesn't exist. So the five neutrals that survived to the end of the war, Ireland, Spain, Portugal, Sweden, Switzerland, all of them to some extent were compromised in terms of their neutrality. So as Joe Lee, the historian, put it, all neutrals are neutral for the side that threatens them most. So, you know, for Switzerland, for Sweden, they would have shown a certain consideration for Germany, of course, because Germany threatened the most. Ireland was probably threatened most by Britain, in the sense that Britain would have taken over Ireland if it needed to, right? So we cooperated at an extensive level, but at a secret level with the Allies, with Britain, and then with Britain and America. We supplied them with meteorological information, we supplied them with intelligence, we released their pilots when they crash landed in Ireland and repatriate them, where we interned the Germans, and we allowed overflights in Donegal, an air corridor, etc., etc., etc. So, like, we now know from the material that's emerged post-war that Ireland was extremely partial towards the Allies. So it wasn't, you know, it was this sort of purest neutrality that we presented to the world and to the Irish people was actually, you know, it was false, essentially. So Ireland, despite the symbolic importance of neutrality for us, we secretly had to make sure that the Allies won the war. And we did that with full cooperation. You know, this is a reality. It's what again, Joe Lee, to quote him, calls a double game. The idea that we give the Allies as much through cooperation as they would gain through conquest. So we make sure that they don't actually invade us and take over the ports, and we make sure that, you know, our benevolent neutrality is actually to their benefit. So the British military intelligence and American intelligence and the military authorities were very happy with Ireland's benevolent neutrality. It meant that Ireland didn't have to be defended, meant that, you know, they could continue to get what they wanted in terms of intelligence, information and news of, you know, German U-boats and anything we could give them. And it also meant then that the hundreds of thousands of Irish who would have had to be conscripted had Ireland joined the war could now go to Britain and work the war economy, for example. So, you know, across a whole range of areas, Ireland's sort of benevolent, sort of secret, or, you know, benevolent neutrality, if we call it that, was to the benefit of the Allies. And then, you know, censorship is used to pretend this isn't happening, to cover that and to say, you know, we are the most neutral country that ever existed. We're so neutral that De Valera will go and visit Edward Hempel, the German minister in Ireland, and the death of Hitler, and offer his condolences on behalf of the Irish people. You know, that's the sort of high point of the absurdity, really, of this situation. Because neutrality becomes less a policy than, I would argue, than a dogma, really, especially after 1942. Because after 1942, the logic of neutrality as a security policy is really diminished. The focus of the war shifts east. Ireland is not really under any real threat. And it could easily have jumped on the Allied bandwagon, for example, and offered a lot more support to the Allies if it wanted to, but it didn't, because at this stage, I think neutrality had become almost a dogma. It wasn't a policy. We're going to stick to this to the bitter end. And it was so important to Fianna Fáil's kind of domestic project that you know, that we're going to stick to the end. And censorship sort of really copper fastened that kind of mentality. So, you know, it's not the kind of, you know, we can look at it in all sorts of different ways. We can be critical of Ireland for not doing enough. We can also be critical of Ireland for doing too little. The idea of neutrality as a sort of some kind of pure and good policy really is not at the races, which isn't to say that neutrality isn't a good thing, and which isn't to say that, you know, the adherence of the state to neutrality subsequently in terms of the formation of NATO, in terms of all the things that develop subsequent, you know, it's useful, it's good, it's a positive thing. I would argue that Ireland didn't become part of any military alliance, that, you know, the more countries that declare neutrality and don't become part of military alliances, then the better for everybody. So even though it was a compromise policy and a contingent policy and a flawed policy in many ways during the war, in the longer term, you know, maybe it's no bad thing that it's such a part of Irish sort of political culture, you know, that we should stick to it.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
While it may have been aiding the Allies, the government was adamant they would maintain the outward perception Ireland was in fact neutral. This saw them institute an extremely strict censorship policy. When we turned to discuss this, Donal first explained the government's thinking on the matter before outlining the censorship regime, which was one of the strictest in Europe.
Because Ireland was militarily defenceless, essentially, there was a belief that the best way Ireland could defend itself was to make sure that it presented itself as neutral, that it wasn't on one side or the other, that it wasn't going to provoke or give any due cause, as they said, to either side to interfere with Irish neutrality or to interfere with the state's sovereignty. So one way of doing that was to sort of neutralize, as I said already, Irish public opinion, to make sure that Irish newspapers or media outlets didn't become a sounding board for propaganda for either side, you know, that the Irish would be impeccably neutral in every way, that Irish public wouldn't veer towards one side or the other. And that involved then having to sort of basically suppress all reports of atrocities, to sort of put a blanket over the Holocaust as it emerged and the Final Solution and the Nazi atrocities, to give equal weight to reports from either side in terms of this is what the Germans said happened, this is what the Allies said happened, to eliminate all propagandist films, to get rid of newsreels, for example. So newsreels were a very important propaganda form, of course, and a way of propagating one side's view. So we were part of the UK and American system. So all the newsreels we would have got would have been from Gaumont and the others who were, and Pathé and so on. And those newsreels were very much the, you know, the classic ones that we see from the Second World War, you know, da-da-da-dun, here's the, you know, the great stories of Allied victories and all of that. In Ireland, we just said, we're not going to have those newsreels, you can't do them. So they were a very important part of their system. So they actually made special Irish newsreels from 1939 to 1942 until it wasn't economically viable to do it anymore. And these newsreels portrayed an entirely different world to the world that was seen by our British neighbours, for example.
To give you a sense of how censorship worked in Ireland during the Second World War, Donal provided this example of a newsreel from 1940.
In mid-May 1940, in the week which saw the arrival of the Dutch government as refugees in London and the bombing of Rotterdam and Canterbury, Gaumont British News, which was the largest circulation newsreel in Ireland and the UK, featured in its Irish edition the following: the New York World Fair, US polo stars playing for charity, a fete in Seville in Spain, a carnival in Zurich, the opening of baseball match in the US, and torrential floods and storms in America. And of course, the Pope proclaiming a saint in Rome. You always have to throw the Pope in any of these ones. So that was that's how the Irish were seeing the world in May 1940 in the cinemas.
With this level of censorship, I asked Donal if Irish people had any real understanding of the wider course of the war that was playing out in Europe.
They did, because British newspapers continued to circulate. So you have this strange situation. Now, a number of them, there were a number of seizures, a number of bannings of British papers, but all of those seizures and bannings related to the newspapers casting doubt on Irish neutrality. None of it had to do with the actual propaganda, the propaganda content. Now, what happened as the war moves on, as it went to even 41, as early as 41, newsprint shortages, transport difficulties, all of that meant like a massive reduction in the number of papers circulating in Ireland. So from hundreds of thousands of British newspapers in 1939, you're down to about 20,000 by 1941. So that's much less effective. You also have radio, of course. You have the, we all know about Lord Haw Haw and all of that coming in, but you have BBC. You don't, everyone doesn't have a radio, and it's before rural electrification, there's a shortage of batteries and so on, but still a significant number of people, especially in the cities, do have access to radio. And so they're listening to radio propaganda, they're tuning in, Gary Fitzgerald used to speak about, listening to the BBC and following the war that way on his radio. But the authorities weren't too bothered about that. What the important thing for them was that Irish newspapers and Irish radio didn't become a forum for either side. So even the Irish newspapers were reporting on the course of the war. Now, not in a way that, was without colour or without embellishment, but nevertheless, they did report that, the Germans have advanced here, the Allies have advanced there, this victory, that victory, this city has taken, that city has taken. So in terms of the bare bones of the narrative of the war, yes, people did know. In terms of the detail of atrocities, of concentration camps, of bombings of, of Dresden, of whatever you want to call it, that wasn't there. That was taken out. So you create a moral distance. I mean, that was the idea. And you create a kind of a, it's almost abstract. And so even though the war is going on, it's going on in the distance. And it's not just physically distant, but sort of morally distant. And that's what they were setting out to achieve.
In light of this, then, I asked Donal if the support for neutrality among the Irish public was in effect a manufactured consent, in that the government led people to this view by censoring their understanding of the wider war.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. I think that's what it is. That's what I say, sort of censorship is propaganda, I call it in one article I wrote, where, the censorship operates as almost a form of negative propaganda for Irish neutrality and for the very particular nature of Irish neutrality. And of course, then it becomes imbued with a kind of moral superiority almost, we're not just outside this conflict, we're above it. All sides are equally bad. So you have people like Frank Aiken, who's the minister in charge of censorship, Jerry Boland, who is the minister for justice, both saying in interviews many, many years later in the 1960s and 1970s, sure, they were both as bad as each other. Look at the Katyn Forest, for example, where the Russians murdered tens of thousands of Polish officers. We knew about that, and that was as bad as anything the Nazis did. Look at Dresden, the bombing of Dresden. Look at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And, Gerard Boland said in the 1960s, the Allies have some cheek trying the Nazis for war crimes when they were responsible for this sort of stuff. So it was this sort of idea that all they were all equally bad. There was the dominant idea, of course, that the British were the worst of all and always would be and always were. Because of Irish experience of British imperialism and colonialism, the world was often seen through the lens of, the British are as bad. Nobody could be worse than the British. or godless Russia, for that matter. So perfidious Albion, godless Russia, the Nazis and Japanese, okay, whatever, they're just part of the make. Yeah, I mean, there was very much a kind of, as you say, a manufacturing of consent, a neutralization of opinion, at the creation of a kind of, a moral distance to underpin this policy, which, as we said at the outset, was really a pragmatic one in many ways, but becomes almost a kind of a dogma and suits the political purposes of Fianna Fáil in particular.
Given the full nature of Nazi atrocities were only revealed at the end of the conflict when censorship was lifted, I asked Donal if the Irish public shifted their view on the government's policy of neutrality in light of this.
No, I mean, I think that once the war ends, there was massive relief that Ireland had survived, right? And that you know, we hadn't been attacked, we hadn't been invaded, we weren't really affected. When Churchill launched his famous attack on Irish neutrality at the war's end, and this gave De Valera a perfect opportunity to reply in his famous broadcast reply, which was published in the Irish press and published as a pamphlet, where he sort of said, you know, you have some cheek, you know, criticizing us and so on and so forth. So people had sort of took great pride in that. And there was really, as the news of the hot, in the immediate aftermath of the lifting of censorship, suddenly the newspapers were filled and the cinemas were filled with reports of the Holocaust, of the concentration camps, of the liberation of the camps. And people sort of turned a blind eye in many ways. They sort of said, oh, that's terrible, but it's all over now. Or they said, that's all British propaganda. We don't believe the half of it. You know, all of that kind of thing. And people, it was a very isolated country, and our neutrality and our censorship in that period, and, you know, the cultural censorship on top of it, sort of strengthened that isolationist sort of mindset. Ireland was very much cut off, and, you know, we weren't allowed into the United Nations until 1955, as you know. So that was partly because the Soviets actually said, you know, Irish neutrality was effectively pro-Axis and we shouldn't allow them in. You know, we were excluded from most martial aid, for example. You know, we weren't part of the kind of post-war sort of Pax Americana. And our isolation then sort of, you know, kind of, I think, deepened that distance that was there from the kind of moral issues of the war itself. Neutrality becomes something different then as we move on, as the Cold War develops, and especially then as Frank Aiken, in his role as Minister for External Affairs or Foreign Affairs in the 1950s, sort of takes a very progressive kind of anti-colonial position within the United Nations, supporting the admission of Red China, supporting the non-proliferation pacts, you know, the non-aligned movement, Yugoslavia and all of that, and sort of saying, you know, the development of these two military blocks in the world is not to the benefit of humanity or peace in the longer term. So Irish neutrality takes on a kind of a more progressive and positive spin then in the 50s, you know, and as we move forward, I mean, that wasn't shared by everyone in the political class, of course. Sean Lamass famously said, there is no such thing as neutrality. We are not neutral. We want to join the EC. We want to become part of the Western camp. Sean McBride said, we will join NATO, but not until partition is gone. So it wasn't, you know, this idea of a principled adherence neutrality in the Irish political class. It continued to be contingent and contested. And, you know, we very clearly and gradually became part of the Western camp. There's no doubt about it. We didn't join NATO, but we facilitated NATO. Once we joined the EEC and the EU developed its defensive dimensions, then we become part of that. But classic Irish ambiguity continues. We pretend that we're neutral, just as we pretended we were neutral during the Second World War, but we're not really. But the majority of Irish people continue to support neutrality, you know, in recent opinion polls. So I think there's a continuation, really, of that sort of gap between what the political elites are doing, both with the policy as a symbol, what the public actually believes, and to what extent that's, you know, a positive or a negative thing. I mean, that's a question of democracy and so on. But certainly what's happening at the moment is, it's quite clear that we're not neutral, given our support for the NATO policies, essentially, our facilitation of American military in Shannon. You know, there's a whole long list of that. And as I say, I think it goes back to the kind of to the sham really of Irish neutrality during the Second World War, if you like. You know what I mean? The gap between reality. And maybe it's raison d'etat, and maybe it's pragmatic, and maybe it makes sense and it's justifiable, you know. But, you know, we don't have to sort of, do we really have to pretend? And those of us who support neutrality and think neutrality is a good idea, I think, you know, have no choice but to sort of say, we must maintain this neutrality. But what we do is we give it actual real shape in a progressive, anti-imperialist, anti-militarist way. Let's put it in the Constitution. It was never put in the Constitution. Why not put it in the Constitution? Do you know, let's make it real. Its history can be tainted and flawed, but that doesn't mean it's not something that we can create as a good thing going into the future.
I want to thank Donal for his time in what was a great discussion. Given next week is a bank holiday, there's going to be no episode, but I'll be back the week after. Until then, Sloan.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.